Today is Friday, December 30th, 2011. This recording is of Dana Dakin, and it is being made in her home in Wilmot, New Hampshire.
I'm Dana Dakin, but you know that, but I'm getting comfortable. Let's see. I was born in California. I'm from California, which certainly informed my life in many subtle ways that surprise me, especially now that I'm not living there. But early on, I wanted to have a career where there were no limits. And I was very lucky to end up in the investment business at quite an entrepreneurial time, and started my own business as a marketing consultant. When you're a marketing consultant working with institutional investors, who are the smartest people, some of the smartest people on earth, you are surrounded by a kind of intellectual capital. And one thing I did as in this firm that I founded was it was necessary to do market research, to go out and ask others about my client and get a fix on my client and where they thought my client was going, what were the possibilities. And in one conversation, I talked to a gentleman named John English. He was the head of the Ford Foundation Endowment, a thought leader. And I had come to know him informally because of this process of qualitative research. The last call I made to him, he said, "Dana, you know I'm retiring." And actually, I didn't know that. And British accent. He said, "I'm retiring because I believe life is in thirds. The first third you learn, the second third you earn, and the last third you return." It shot me right into the heart. I mean, it was like Cupid sending an arrow. I was stunned by it. I was in my mid-40s, maybe late-40s. And so I tucked that away, and it became a very important structure, a conceptual structure for moving ahead with my life. It's so easy to hold on to a career and the earn piece, and it's so exciting to officially say, "This is ending," as he did, as he was doing, and move on to return. And so I moved to New Hampshire. That it wasn't understood. It was a subconscious, unconscious desire to get away from the competitive push of my career and settle in a place where there was a sense of place and slow down in order to get ready and honor the return phase of my life. So that construct is what got me to make the decision to make age 60, the return, the beginning of my return phase, which happened in 2003. I had an example of a woman who had gone to Nepal when she was 60, and she had gone on a trek. She was not going to start a return phase. She was still working in the Supreme Court of California as a very high-level individual, professional. And she saw the poverty in Nepal and started on that trip to partner and came back and started a daycare center for the street sweepers, the women she had observed sweeping the streets at 4 and 5 a.m., using chemicals with children, babies on their back, And that's where she started. And then gradually wound down her career. And she, at now age 87, by the way, is going strong. And she has had impact in that country. I worked for her probably at age 65, her age 65. And I was a pro bono marketing consultant to her. I got to Nepal, and that's where I decided that 60 would be the beginning of my return phase. I had her as an example. In preparing for the return phase of my life, I moved to New Hampshire. Or that was a piece of it that was important because it gave me space to go deeper in my life and really think consciously about what did I want to do at age 60. That was my goal at age 60, to follow in the footsteps of this wonderful woman who had gone to Nepal named Olga Murray. And so I would walk along. Age 58 was happening, 58 and a half. And I said, well, what are you going to do? And it wasn't clear to me what I was going to do. So you have to start saying, okay, let's narrow it down. I want to work internationally. I know the need is great. I read these stories about the people suffering there. I've been to Africa once. I went to East Africa on a safari, and I could see it was devastating. And so I said, Africa. It's going to be Africa. And one morning I woke up with the whole idea. You're going to go to Africa, find a village, and start a microlending program. Microlending appealed because I had been a woman entrepreneur, and microlending is almost 98% about helping women be successful entrepreneurs. In a developing economy, the women almost always work, and they work in what's called the informal economy and make so little per day. But they are entrepreneurs. If they don't wake up and motivate themselves to start the work, do the work, and finish the day with money in their pocket, their family won't eat. So the concept of microlending appealed to me, and I personally identified with it. So microlending, okay. Check. Now, I didn't know anything about microlending, but I started talking about it. Had read a couple of articles in the paper, and someone gave me Banker to the Poor by Muhammad Yunus, who since that my founding of Women's Trust became a Nobel Peace Prize winner. Microlending, Africa. So what was left? Find a village. Well, in the investment business, which had been my whole career, you, even if you're a bottom-up stock picker, you look at top-down indicators. You do not want to be buying a stock where it's in a bad industry or it's in the wrong country or the forces beyond its own character do not work in its favor. So I said, okay, I'm going to have to pick a country. There are 53 countries in Africa. You can't fly to Africa. So I need a country that is safe, that has not had a lot of conflict, where there is some stability in the government, maybe a sign of a democratic process emerging, an economic trend that is somewhat favorable, and they speak English. And it was clear, Ghana was the obvious choice. So I said, great, now I have a country. I know what I'm going to do. So how do I find a village? Well, I didn't know anyone in Ghana. But from my work, I knew how to network. And I started talking about my idea and asking people if they knew anyone in Africa, and slowly assembled a small list of names of people who were working in Africa. And one was through a professor of religion at my college. I had been on the board, and she did a board retreat speech, and it was on a goddess of fishing in Ghana. So I called her, and she gave me a number of names. I called, someone gave me the name of a nun in Tamale. Someone gave me, it was just miscellaneous, but one contact I had was my trainer in New York. I had worked out of New York and had an apartment, and I got to know a trainer who in a gym who then started coming to my house to put me through the paces. And he had been born in Los Angeles, but his father was Ghanaian. And so I called him. I hadn't seen him for years. And his father indeed was still alive and lived in Ghana. So I got his name. And then my birthday was coming. It was January 2003. I couldn't get a hold of these people. Nothing had gelled. And I know that if you have a goal of, say, do something by age 60, that if you let it slip, if you don't honor that goal, you miss it. So I was determined to have this thing start at 60, this thing. And booked a flight. March 2003, we had just invaded Iraq that fall. It was not a great time to be going anywhere. Of course, people thought I was rather crazy. And I arrived, checked into a hotel that some people who I had talked to from USAID had recommended. By the way, the most expensive hotel I've ever stayed in Ghana. And the next morning, I called the father of my trainer. His name is Hope Tawia. His son is Tete. And he picked up the phone, which now I know is unusual, and said, "We're waiting for you." And I said, "Excuse me." He said, "No, we have a village for you to stay in. We've talked to the chief. We thought you'd be comfortable staying with a white person. There is one white person in the village, and we went to him and we found a room. He will rent you a room for $5 a night, and we'd like to pick you up tomorrow." And I said, "What about the day after tomorrow?" And 10 o'clock, the day after that morrow, I was telephoned in my hotel room. I was all packed. I figured that I would follow what my grandmother used to tell me, that if you go someplace where you don't know where you're being taken, you take mad money. So I figured I could get home by a cab. And indeed, I could have, but it wasn't necessary. The fact that they were on time is, again, now I know, unusual. So I walked out to the front desk, and I passed two gentlemen, and one was wearing a flowered shirt and was relatively light-skinned, and the other was in a long white dress, a staff, bare feet, and a turban, very dark. And I said, "Well, that's not them," and went to the front desk, and she pointed right to them, and sure enough, they were the ones taking me to a village called Pokwasi. So I got in the car not a fancy car, and was driven out to this village, and it turned out it was in the outskirts of Accra, the northwest corner, right off the Kumasi Highway, and 45 minutes, an hour away from where I was picked up. The traffic was light. I was taken to where I was going to stay, met the Dutchman who owned this house that he was converting into kind of a village club on the outskirts of Pokwasi. The room looked great, very exciting. Just a fan. There was indoor plumbing. There were people working for him who stayed there also. And then I was taken to the chief, Ni Adokwami. The chief was an enlightened man. He lived in town. He had open hours on weekends. And he was having one of those open sessions. And I was taken to meet him. And he welcomed me. He said, "I hope you will like our town. If I can do anything for you while you're here in those 2 weeks, I'd be happy to." And I went back and got settled in. Walking the village, I was the only white person walking around. There I am, just wandering around. I've been dropped off. And felt immediately comfortable. It was the strangest feeling to see the body language and have it so familiar. The way people exchanged, the way they conducted business, the enterprise, the friendliness, I came to understand that the U.S., our country, has been tremendously influenced by West Africa. And the way we walk, the way we talk, the way we sing and dance has had tremendous impact from the West Africa. So it's actually familiar. I never felt unsafe, in danger. But it was kind of, how am I going to meet women? The chief introduced me to a sub-chief, or recommended a sub-chief, the Jaman chief, and he is a delightful older man who kind of is in charge of a hamlet. And so he assembled the women to meet with me and hear what I was talking about, and I told them where I was staying and that they were welcome to come as a group, and I would explain microlending to them. And then the gentleman I was staying with took me to churches, and we would stand at the side of the door on a Sunday and until they invited us in, and I would get in front of the congregation and explain what I was there for, where I was staying, and that they were very welcome to come. And so women started coming. Loans and money are always big news in a town mired by poverty. And of course it's very easy for them to link that it's a white person with money, so it may be a grant and not a loan, which is something that took time to educate them on, that there was an obligation on their part, that it wasn't a rich woman coming into town and just handing out money. At the end of the 2 weeks, I threw a party. I had the woman next door to the Dutchman do the catering. I invited everyone I had met. I love parties. And it was sensational. I had seen the chief 2 days before at that weekend session that he held the each at his palace. He called it his palace. And he said, how did it go? And I said, I have decided to stay in Poquasi. I'm very excited about the possibilities. And he said, you will work through me. And just on gut wisdom, having life experiences under my belt, I said, no, I won't be able to work through you. It's important. This is woman to woman. But I will keep you informed. And that was a key turning point or a moment, because what I was doing basically is establishing that this was an organization that was truly what's called bottom up. There is no layer between the giving and the receiving. And that helps eliminate two things: corruption, the possibility for corruption, which is a loaded word and needs to be unraveled when people head out to do something like this. And the other, besides the corruption piece, was that it was personal. The relationship was going to be personal and dependable and evolutionary and adaptable and a listening model where we work directly with local people and it becomes their program. I returned from my first trip to Poquasi and Ghana, and I was returning in April. The contrast of coming back to New Hampshire from a vibrant, warm weather, huge energy, people, everyone struggling to make a living, lots of activity in this town, to our quiet village setting here was dramatic. And it's very easy to return home from an experience like this. In fact, they told me, they said, no one ever comes back. We're interested. They didn't say we're interested. They're not that. They don't use those words, but they were interested. But they didn't trust that I would come back, because they said no one comes back. People come, they see the need, they promise us things, and they never come back. And I returned, and sure enough, as time started passing, I said, wait a minute. This is a crazy idea. I can't do this. It's that second guesser in your head. And if I had active family members, they would be saying, Dana, are you crazy? You can't do this. And that voice I had to deal with. And I decided what I needed to do go back, number one. I was going to go back, and I promised within 6 months that I would be back, and I would honor that promise, and that the money I brought back to start the loan program, there were 200 interested women. I had hired an administrator to find out how to become a corporation and become incorporated and also become an NGO. That would happen the next trip. The money would need to come from a source that was not crazy. And I had a second car. I decided to sell my second car and use that as seed capital for this. And if it turned out to be a risk where I didn't understand the consequences and all of that money was gone, what had I lost? A second car. So I built up steam and got ready, booked to go back, stayed again with the Dutchman, had a place to stay, knew what I was walking into. I had an administrator and potential clients for the micro-lending program. But what was shocking to me was the administrative couple I chose were totally organized. They knew exactly what I needed to do to start. They knew where to go. They had researched it. Highly complex process, frankly. I've seen others come since me and stumble. So I, once again, luck, knowing my trainer, having his father there, meant to be. Having the chief interested and having that strange man, the bear with bare feet, that was the fetish priest. The chief's fetish priest, the chief assigned that man to me to be my driver and protector. Staying with the Dutchman who knew the town well and took me to churches, meant to be. And finding Agnes and George, he had been a treasurer of a corporation and was retired. She had been senior as a school administrator. This under British rule. And of course, all of that fell apart after the British left. Independence was declared. Tough, tough time for Ghana. It seemed like it would be a glory time, but it was a tough transition for many, many reasons outside of the control of the marvelous people in that country who wanted to have such success right away. So I got there and talk about on the ground running. To have a woman, Agnes Baidu, say, the first thing we have to do is write a constitution. We have rented a room in a hotel because we want you to be able to concentrate, and we have a draft. And so this is unreal. When I left 3 months later, 3 weeks later, we had the constitution, we were incorporated, we were an NGO, fully registered. I had to pay a little money under the table. We had interviewed 200 women. We had reduced it down to 100. We had all our forms printed. We had the bookkeeping system organized. And they were ready to start the loan program January of 2004. My next trip was 6 months later. Generally, I went back twice a year. I think it's important to go back twice a year in the beginning. And the Baidus, George and Agnes, were doing a great job. They were, the office was in their home, which was slightly outside of the down, essentially a couple of blocks, a quarter of a mile out of the downtown. And they were impeccable books, good relationship with the bank. The women would come, were coming and repaying, because that's the key, is to have the money repay. First cycle, terrific success. Second cycle, really disappointing. And that is because the women at that point started saying to themselves, a rich white person, this is her money. And if we repay once, we'll get another loan, and then we don't need to repay after that. So this is something that new programs have to expect. And the sooner you get away from it looking like it's dependent on an outsider, a wealthy outsider, or comparatively wealthy outsider, the better. Another problem emerged, and that was that the Baidus had not grown up in the town. They had retired in the town of Poquassi. They were of the Ga tribe and spoke the local language as well as Twi and also excellent English. They were well educated. but they weren't of the town. And therefore, her ability to market to new women was limited. And it fell on my shoulders, and that was a weakness. So we needed to find, to move ahead and find a more local person who knew the women and was well known. And that person was Gertrude Ancra. Gertrude, Gertie, as we call her, is goes back generations in Poquasi. She is politically active and a modern woman, a strong leader. She has tremendous potential to go far. And she joined our team as director of marketing 6 months after that. She and the Bedous were not able to align, and ultimately we opened an office right in the downtown in the first official government building. We were given a free office because we had credibility, growing credibility in the town because of our ongoing commitment to the town in microlending. We had met many of the people in the town, the government officials, churches. We knew the chief. We knew the chief's assistants. We knew teachers. And so we got this office. We hired Gertie. She hired a very respected youngish man to be her office assistant. And we, by that time, had introduced scholarships for girls. I had no idea when I got there to do microlending that the problem for women goes right back to education. I had no idea that public school costs money in a poor country. I had no idea that the U.S. and the IMF had actually influenced that policy. But the upshot was that girls were not literate. They were not kept in school. They had to do the chores. They weren't culturally supported in advancing in school. And on the U.S. side, I started doing research on that educating girls was the magic was the magic formula for all change. So we added a very small pilot educate girls, keep them in school program. We did some great, we avoided some of the obvious ways that a system like that could be beat, and that is, for instance, having a group of people who are the deciders on which girl gets the scholarship and have it an inside deal. So we really worked hard and did many, many things right. In fact, our only issue in our scholarship program over this time as it's evolved, we're up to 138 girls, is to figure out the ongoing funding. And so there we are with a microlending program run in the town by local people. We had scholarships for girls and enrichment. By that time, interns were coming. They were innovating. Volunteers were coming. They were bringing training for the women to improve their skills. And all of many, many of these pieces were absolutely right on. There is a backlash to going beyond microlending as a quote unquote British term scheme, and adding blatant social good. The odd thing is microlending is touted as advancing women and supporting social good. But what has been happening in the microlending field is The accepted process is to strip away all social good and make it strictly a money-making business. The capital alone is all that you want to do, and you really don't want to get in the business, the supplementary programs. And so there was a fork in the road there, two paths we could go down, and we chose the social good path. And very happy to do that. We've added health care, healthy living, that we know how to do, and we will do, integrate it into our program as the money comes in to support that in a sustainable way. But we are believers that microlending is a tool. It is a tool to put in the hands of women who drive forward their own path. We have added an entrepreneurs club that was funded by the UN African Mothers Association. This is exceptional because it adds a higher tranche loan, and the women can get as much as $5,000. We started with loans that were $20. The minimum loan now is $50, but it goes all the way to $5,000. So we have tremendous examples in town of women who are the sharpest going far. And the requirement is that they hire women with limited business skill and teach them business and pay them a salary. So this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, a locally run, the whole town starts moving forward by adding the social piece, the keep girls in school piece, the healthy living piece, and it has become a beloved program with tremendous cultural impact because of our community-focused, because of the involvement of so many constituencies. One of the big indicators of culture change is, what about the men? What's happened with the men? This is an emphasis on girls and women, and I will tell you that the men are 100% in favor of this, and the change in the way wives are treated, the way girls are honored. Men are partnering with their wives in the business because unemployment is high. The young men have formed a community association, a community development association, and they say, "We have watched you, Dana. We have watched you come back, and you never quit. You never quit. If you have a setback, you say, 'What can we do about this?' And we've watched you, and we've now started a community association where we are standing up to power, and we are saying, 'Where is the money for road improvement? Where is the money to improve schools? We want it now.'" They're demonstrating. So the town has changed because of these relatively small protocols, support systems, an energy to innovate and listen and enrich lives, and we are trusted. We keep coming back, and we are trusted partners in the town, and the town has changed because of it. At the 9-year mark in 2012, the beginning of 2012, I have the privilege of stepping down to the side and becoming founder only. I will relinquish the CEO part of my job and also not be a part of the U.S. board except in an emeritus status. We have many things in place that are promising, that promise a good future, and it's very important for a founder to step back and allow the organization to take on a new energy and go forward to to definite goals. Run it. It's been run like a business, but it's been run like a small business. And now it needs to be run like a worked out business. Last year, we hired an executive director in Ghana. She has superb talent and credentials. She's from Accra, age 35, had worked in banking, Echo Bank, a progressive bank, received a master's from the London School of Economics, went to the University of Ghana, went up through the public system, but was privileged in a Ghanaian sense. Her father was a doctor, her mother a nutrition expert, and it was in her from her beginning to do something for her country. And we were lucky enough, with a formal executive search process run by a board of directors in Ghana who I had recruited the year before, we were able to find this candidate. And she is going to transform our beginnings. We also have in place the land for a resource center. It's in Pokwasi, and Pokwasi is relatively close because of highway construction, getting all the closer to downtown Accra. We have a site that will be a center for women's leadership and empowerment and girls' education. We have the beginning of the capital for that site, and it will become a reality. It will put us at a very high, visible status in the country, standing for the advancement of women, the bringing women into power positions, empowering of women, and girls' education around the country. We have a good, solid staff in the U.S. and supporters that are local supporters who have been extremely important from the very beginning and will now be going after grant money from foundations and other places because we have the numbers in the evidence of success that is necessary to go after proposals. So that allows me to look at what might be my next step. And this next year will be my 10th year. In that 10th year, I will be a resource to both the Ghanaian staff and also to the U.S. staff, both boards, and be available in whatever way is needed to tell the founder's story and support the effort of going after money. I also want to direct my creative energy and my love of freedom to the second half of our mission, which is to inspire others to do the same elsewhere. It's a vague statement. It has been there for years now. And to me, what that means is keep it simple. Be on the ground. Be accessible to others in our incredibly resourced country who have a yearning to give back, to do their return piece in a place beyond their normal community where there is a social safety net available, and go to a place where no social safety net exists and bring problem-solving skills, small amounts of capital, a continuity of support and partnership, and follow in the footsteps in the Women's Trust model. We have attracted people to come to Ghana with varying levels of success. They all are still going. They've adapted to their situation with the resources and the ability that they bring, and that's the beauty of what we're doing, what the Women's Trust model allows. It is not rigid. It is not formulaic. It's based on values and partnering and listening. I believe that there is a large number of people in this country, returning Peace Corps volunteers, people who have done very well in business. For example, I've come to know from my field many financial women and received a terrific award in New York. And in accepting that Isabel Benham Award, 700 women were in the audience, and my 7-minute story resonated. There was a long line of women saying, I want to do that. How can I do that? I want to do what you've done. Because this story of me heading off and keeping it personal and being committed it's a large undertaking, and I certainly have many lessons learned that I would share with others in some structured way of my helping people take off with the highest probability of being able to succeed. I think that there are a number of people who will bring the same impact on the ground, person to person, where you change culture dramatically because it isn't big, because it isn't a large, nameless organization with lots of money coming in, helicoptering in, fanning the money out, and then leaving when they lose interest. This is a human partnering idea, and it has tremendous potential.